Welcome to the Brain Health Mission podcast, exploring how science, policy, and everyday choices shape the health of your brain and what you can do to protect it.
Hello, and welcome back to the Brain Health Mission podcast, where we explore the science, strategies, and the stories behind brain health in neurology. Your host, Dr. Jana Middelfarthof, I'm a neurologist and treasurer of the European Academy of Neurology. And I am joined by Professor Max Hiltz. You are an internationally recognized neurologist, and you are specialized in the autonomic nervous system. That means the system that is not controlled by the will, you know, like the bowel and the breathing and so on, and disorders of this particular part of the nervous system. You also specialized in clinical neurophysiology, and also additionally in neurological intensive care medicine. So you have a very broad background, and that is very nice as a guest in our podcast. You have led a lot of international neurological and autonomic societies, and you have made guidelines, and you have also, as an esteemed scientist, you published a lot in your field, and also actually are the author of a textbook, which is quite exciting. Even though you have been focusing on medicine, on anatomy, on physiology, and how the nervous system is built, you also have a particular interest in how to cope with stress, stress-related disorders, and you have especially emphasized the value of autogenic training. And we are going to talk about that, especially in this episode. We are not the only one who would like to have you as a guest. You have also been honored with several prizes and also lectures for all your contribution to neurology, to autonomic medicine, and to neuroscience in general. Was that a nice introduction? You have so much that I could speak about, Max, so I tried to.
Well, fortunately, you don't make me blush because I'm trying to relax. So thank you for the flowers.
Super. We all need them, and they were so well deserved. But if we should say it in two words, you are a so-called autonomic expert. And to simplify that, one could say, as I said, that you are an expert of the autonomous part of the nervous system. That means the part of the nervous system that we cannot control or not voluntarily control, such as bowels and breathing and digestion. You don't think about, do I digest or not, when you're sitting in a meeting or when you're sitting in the bus and so on.
Well, you start to think about it when it doesn't work and you sit in the bus and you can't control your bowel functioning longer or your bladder function. And that's, of course, terrible. When you stand up and since you shift some, you cannot control that any longer and you can't counter-regulate. You will feel dizzy or you may faint or you may lose your consciousness completely. And basically, the autonomic nervous system controls everything. I tell my students, from up at your hair down to your toenails and anything in between, sleep, respiration, everything we don't have to care about. Only when it starts not to work properly, we are in trouble, in very serious trouble. And many, many diseases are associated with autonomic dysfunction, many neurological diseases, many internal medicine disorders, like diabetes, for example, goes along with a lot of bowel dysfunction, of cardiovascular dysfunction. The heart cannot control blood pressure properly, the vessels don't constrict adequately, and many, many other problems, including sweating, it doesn't work the way it should work, and so on. So a whole realm we cannot even imagine if we don't dive into that.
So you could say in a way that when the autonomic nerve system is working, we don't care about it very much. But if it does not work, then we will indeed recognize it.
Yes, in most cases. Of course, when you are very excited because you have to run up the stairs, and your heart is pounding and you feel the palpitations in your fingers, you realize this is happening and you can't stop it. When you are having an important podcast, you might be excited and nervous about it and you don't know how to control it. That's the autonomic nervous system, because what it does, it creates stress. Any external stimulus that is a challenge, also any disease that is a challenge, fever, headache, whatever, is a stressor. And the term stress was coined by Hans Selye, the Austrian-Canadian researcher, only in the 30s or late 20s, 30s, in I think 36, he coined the term. He said there is no general definition of stress, but it is basically any non-specific response of the body to an external or internal demand for change. That's a very general definition. Nowadays, we have other definitions or probably more precise, but whenever such a situation occurs, the autonomic system is different from what it is at rest, and it could cause a lot of trouble.
That's true. And you can't cheat very much on autonomic nervous system. Like you say, if you start to run, then your heart will beat faster because that's a part of a reaction. And I actually spoke to a mother of a student yesterday, and she said that she had a very nice observation when he had been drinking, because when he's claimed he hadn't been drinking, because when he starts on his second glass of wine, he will always get very flushed in his face. So she, so even though he claims that he's only been drinking water, she can sort of.
Alcohol is a vasodilating substance. You shouldn't drink alcohol when you go onto an airplane, because I had a lot of transatlantic flights because of the fact that I also worked in the States and in Germany. And I cannot count how many times I was confronted with people who fainted on the flight. You probably also had that experience that they call, is there a doctor on board? And then say, okay, I'm coming. And in many cases, it's just that people don't realize you have to drink more because you have no control over the autonomic, unnoticed loss of fluid. You sweat without feeling it. Perspiratio insensibilis. It's, you don't sense it. And that's in an airplane. So the air pressure is lower, the oxygen level is a little lower, and people drink because they're nervous and they think, I want to sleep. And that vasodilates and they stop walking around. And as net result, once they stand up, they may faint. So that's the autonomic nervous system that is not taken care of. When you exercise and you stop immediately, and everyone who's used to jogging or to endurance training will not stop abruptly. And any cardiologist who does a challenge test on the heart function also tells you slow down at the end of the tests until your pulse rate is back down. If you don't, you will faint. You will lose consciousness. When I started working on a very, very difficult disease with inborn dysfunction of the autonomic nervous system, I quickly realized that when these children, they were usually children, it's very rare Ashkenazi Jewish disease, they had a life expectancy of around 6 years, 5-6 years. By now, it's up to 50 years. So a big change, because we have better access to autonomic function and controlling it. And I learned when they're stressed, they can immediately trigger a so-called autonomic crisis. Their blood pressure can go through the roof. They sweat profusely as if they came out of the bathtub, and the psychological situation is in total disarray, and it's a high-risk situation. And if you can calm down these people, you can avoid such a situation.
So to the listeners, do drink when being on an airplane, but not alcohol, because that will exactly. dehydrate you even further. If you're exercising, which you should do on a regular basis, then take some time to gear down and do not go from 100 to zero, because as Max here says, that is not good for you and you may end up fainting, which definitely is not a very wise thing to do on the asphalt or wherever. And we also now are starting about calming the autonomic nerve system down, because even though it cannot be influenced so easily as the voluntarily nervous system, you can't say just start to digest, you can control it in some ways or at least modulate it. And that is the thing we're going to talk about mainly, Max.
Autogenic training is a training that generates something by itself. If you want to relax and you're totally under stress, I have a lot of friends, some of them prestigious neurologists, tell me, I have too much stress right now. It's terrible. You know, I can't sleep. I can't relax. And some of them, I taught them, you want me to show you how to relax? Oh, no, this is not going to work. In the cases where I really did it, was fortunate enough to show them, yes, it works very well. How does it work? It's based on no religious beliefs, on no philosophy or any esoteric thoughts, but just on the fact that it is basically reinforcing what you predict. Schultz came from the days in the 19th century, basically. He published his first book in 1927, but of course, on the autonomic nervous system, so 99 years ago. But of course, that book was basically the summary of decades of experience. And he started with hypnosis, something Sigmund Freud started with. He carefully recorded what his patients told him. What do you feel in the beginning of such a hypnotic state? Well, I feel calm. I feel relaxed. What do you feel in terms of your body functions, your arms, your legs? Before we started, you were restless. You were always moving around. And, well, you know, there heavy, they're relaxed, not really uncomfortable heavy, but I mean, I don't want to move them. It's just comfortable not to move them. And he took note of all of that. And he took note. So basically, it starts, he took note with something that many, many of his patients, if not all of them, reported. And he said, what if I first tell them, you can be calm, you can relax, noise doesn't bother you. And if you start with that, and then you say, okay, turn your attention, let's say, to your left arm or to your right arm, and feel it. It has some weight. It is heavy. It's not uncomfortable heavy. But of course, if you rest your arm on a chair and you focus on it and you relax, you feel, oh, okay, it has some weight. It's not like weightlifting, but it just has some weight. And you feel what this guy told me and what I want to feel is really happening. And it's like self-repetitive perpetuum mobile. So, but anyone who really wants to relax, when you use these different steps, it's going to work.
You've already delved a little into that, but how can autogenic training be good for coping with the stress and then consequently also be a good thing for your brain health?
Okay, so that requires that I speak a little bit about what happens during stress. So during stress, we activate what's called the sympathetic nervous system. So the sympathetic nervous system is that part when you have to work very hard, when you walk up the stairs, when you're preparing for a very difficult conversation, your heart rate is faster, your blood pressure is higher, you might even start sweating a little bit. That dates back to thousands and thousands, if not millions of years, because in those days when we were exposed to an acute stressful situation, it could be a very dangerous situation where we had to run away or had to fight and defend ourselves. At the days of the caveman, you had to widen your pupils because in the cave there was no electric light bulb, not even a candle, nothing. So in darkness or when it gets dark, the autonomic nervous system automatically widens the pupils so that more light comes in. And all of these things, we breathe deeper, faster, we have a better exchange, more oxygen goes in, more carbon dioxide goes out of our lungs, everything needed to basically be in a position where we can defend ourselves, where we can run away. That's a term described by Walter Cannon already 20 years before Hans Selye described the term stress, and he called it the fight and flight response. And some people also call it the fright response because it also mounts when we are exposed to something that scares us a lot. And that is a very important response. But so the sympathetic is up and the calming down. So the parasympathetic is the rest and digest system that's prominent when we sleep, when we relax. During stress, there's too much sympathetic, too little parasympathetic. On top of that, there is a whole realm of endocrine changes. The brain, the so-called hypothalamus, talks to the pituitary gland. The pituitary gland immediately releases substances called ACTH that release cortisol from the kidneys, from the suprarenal part. And in that case, cortisol is needed because it triggers energy release, glucose, gluconeogenesis, and of course, lipolysis. So fat is released and formed into energy, and you can use that. But if it works acutely, it can become very dangerous. If it's too much, the system could break down. If it works chronically, constantly too much sympathetic, high blood pressure, racing heart rate is not healthy. It's very dangerous. It causes a lot of diseases. Constantly high cortisol is extremely bad because you lose your ability to mount responses that fight inflammation is attenuated. It doesn't work properly. You lose muscle function. You can even lose bone density, etc., etc. A lot of side effects of cortisol, which we as physicians, of course, are very familiar with, but probably not the lay audience. And that this combination of too much sympathetic, of too much cortisol is absolutely dangerous. In the short run, if it's too much, you can die, sudden death, or in the long run, it can cause a stroke, it can cause heart attack, and a thousand other problems.
But, to sum up, Max, you could say that it's useful to have these fight and flight, fright, whatever responses we call them, because it's important for survival. I mean, when you suddenly, there comes a car and it rushes very fast, then you need to jump away. Otherwise, you will be driven over and that will be game over, so to say. But what you are explaining us, and in a very good way, is that too much of it, either acutely or too much over longer time, is a destructive power. It's a superpower there and then to save us from life-threatening events, but not in the long run all the time.
Yes, that's absolutely right. There are some people, I don't use the term, but there are some people who even speak of eustress, because when you are stressed, for example, Anyone in sportive competition is stressed, but when he wins, he is excited, he's happy, and afterwards he wants to celebrate, because when the risk is over and you made it and you mastered the challenge or you survived the battle, you want to celebrate your survival or your success. You release a lot of dopamine, which of course makes you active, happy, and joyful, etc., etc. And with autogenic training, you can rearrange this disbalance. Of course, nobody's going to start autogenic training when he's really in a dangerous situation and needs to escape. He's happy that he can still mount a fight and flight response. Also, people usually don't know what that is, but they mount it, and that's very good. But with autogenic training, chronic stress as well as acute stress, when you prepare, you have to go to the dentist. You know, this time he's going to drill, and it's, I don't like it, I hate it. I know grown-up, very successful business people, sometimes when these people hear a drill somewhere, they hate it because it reminds them and recalls unpleasant memories. It hurts. You can use autogenic training very successfully to mitigate the pain and the anxiety. And how does it work? When you relax, when you have a system that, let's talk about sleep. When you're sleeping, you have a lot of parasympathetic. Autogenic training has nothing to do with sleep. You have, when you record brain waves, you have a pattern as someone has it who's fully awake. It's not the pattern you have when you sleep. So when you are in deep sleep, you have what we call delta waves, very slow waves. When you're awake, you have alpha waves. They're much faster. And the same is true when someone is in a state of autogenic training. It's not slow delta waves. You're fully awake and alert. Still, you're calm. You're relaxed. You have more parasympathetic, more rest and digest activity, and less of the activity that is associated with stress. And that you can learn.
And that is so true. We are not listeners giving you the autogenic training experience here and now, but Max is going to describe steps in a process of autogenic training, and then you could try that at home later when you are in a calm setting and you feel ready to do this. And you could also go into further literature on the theme, because you have some hooks that you can put your knowledge on. So Max, it's time for your steps.
Yeah, thank you. So I also want to mention that there are a lot of, in the internet, on whatever, YouTube or whatever you want to use, I'm sure, I didn't search, but I'm sure you find everything there, including videos of autogenic training. There are also recordings of autogenic training. But I have some problems with this, because I really want to have the interaction with the person in whom I try to help. I'm not inducing this. I'm just telling the person what the person might feel. And if the person doesn't want to feel it, as I said before, it's not going anywhere. But I cannot influence anyone. When you see these circus performances, they select thousands of potential volunteers. And there are specific tests that have been described already by Ihar Schulz 100 years ago, which you can use to find out whether somebody is easily accessible to suggestion. And then when you see that guy who does hypnosis, he says something and the person starts to hop around like a monkey or something like that, that's of course all baloney, because these are very highly selected, 1, 2, 3, 5 out of 2,000 or so. And that's something I don't want to share with. So I don't want to be put in the same frame as these people. because it is a highly useful medical procedure. As I just said, in many cases, it works better than something like sedating benzodiazepine, Valium, most people know, of course, there are many others, but I guess almost everybody has heard the word Valium. And what happens? You cannot drive a car afterwards. You have to make sure that you don't cause an accident. After autogenic training, you return to the status you had before, and you're fine. And also, there are very few contraindications when it comes to autogenic training. You should not do it in anyone who just had a psychotic episode or who has a chronic psychotic disease like schizophrenia or who has a very severe obsessive compulsive disorder. And with an unknown audience, you never know to whom you're talking. Nevertheless, so these are the steps. The first step is that you tell people that the noise, the surrounding noise, people say, I can't, you know, my phone is ringing all the time. And then someone is knocking the door and outside they're talking very loudly and that disturbs me. No, you can tell yourself, this is not going to disturb you. You just try to calm down. It's not going to work with a snip of a finger, but it takes some time and the training usually takes several weeks. And you learn one step after the other, because if you do everything at once, people might be frustrated. In many cases, it works in my experience, but for someone who wants to learn, do it step by step. The next step is that you feel that your right is heavy. The best position to do it is to be flat on the floor, on a mattress, on your bed, in a comfortable position. But you also can do it in your office. When you're sitting at your office desk, you can rest your arms on the desk. And after a while, you feel, oh, really, my arm has some weight. Of course it has some weight. And then you go to the next arm and both arms, and you imagine that they're heavy, and then come the legs, and so on. And the second step is then that when you relax, of course, you start to lower the sympathetic. The blood pressure is high, the heart rate is chasing, the small vessels are constricted. That's what brings blood pressure up. No, it goes down. And sooner or later, with relaxation, you feel, aha, it's warm because more blood comes to your extremities and it actually. Your hand or your foot might feel somewhat warmer. After some while, it really does. What really happens is that in the central autonomic network, the systems, there are many systems that talk to each other. And these systems, basically, they lower the output of sympathetic activity that mainly comes from a specific area in the brainstem. And they increase parasympathetic activity, just as if we start to fall asleep, but you're not falling asleep, as I said before. So the next thing is that you feel it's warm, it's comfortably warm, it's relaxed, it's heavy, you're quiet, it's warm. And again, right side, left side, the hands, the arms, then the legs, feet, left, right, etc. And when this autonomic change continues with more parasympathetic, with more rest and digest activity, your heart rate is somewhat slowing down. But it's also, you feel the pulsation sometimes in your fingertips. You can feel the heart rate. Look, you don't usually feel that. When I speak about autonomic modulation, I sometimes tell my students, think about a motorcycle. And when the engine is running and you stand at the red light, it goes boom, 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 boom. And when you're racing down the street, it just goes brrrr. So you don't hear the explosions. And that's the same when your heart goes really fast. You don't necessarily feel any palpitation in your finger pulps. But when you slow down, when you relax, you start to feel it. And you start to feel your heart. And you feel, very few people are worried about that. They need not be worried unless they have a cardiac disorder. They have some disorder of the heart rhythm, so-called arrhythmia. But that's the next step. So the next step is my heart beats strongly, regularly, rhythmically, and it's relaxing. And what happens next? Your respiration is slower. Slow respiration at around, we breathe 12 times when we're at rest, around 12 times per minute. And when we relax, it's slower. It goes down. It can go down even to half that frequency. So only 6 times per minute. And 6 times per minute in autonomic testing is a perfect test to see how much parasympathetic activity can someone really raise. And the sympathetic activity rises at 6 times. That means 5 seconds in, 5 seconds out is 10 seconds, times 6 is 60 seconds, 1 minute. You have a perfect, optimal parasympathetic modulation. And that happens with relaxation. So when I then, at a later stage, tell people, and your respiration goes totally automatically, the air flows in, and like the waves at the sea, they come and they go, it all goes automatically. The person who does that feels, I don't have to do anything. It goes automatically. And I feel comfortable. I'm relaxed. So it's a constant repetition of, I predict something which is going to happen. And the moment the person experiences this, the person is reassured. It functions. This guy is not talking baloney, but I really can relax. And after some weeks, it gets better and better. And they assure, when they mediate more relaxation, they assure that the small arteries that surround and are working within our guts, our bowels, the small intestine and the colon, they are dilated. So it gets warmer. All organs are better perfused. 30% of our blood flow go to the gastrointestinal tract. And if we relax, more goes there. After a heavy meal, you're tired because less blood is here, more blood is in your stomach, so to say. And so that's the next step, that you feel, it's warm, I'm relaxed. And there's another step. You want to keep a cool head. Actually, I'm sure Schulz also didn't know that, because only a few years ago, there was a publication showing that with cooling pads on the forehead, you can activate the parasympathetic system. Well, that's the cold face test. We've known that for a long time, but it's recently been published in the context of migraine treatment. It helps in migraine. On the other hand, there are few cases that are sensitive to cold stimuli, and in those, I would skip that part. But otherwise, I guess Schulz thought more about the fact that you want to stay cool in a stressful situation. So keep a cool head, a cool brain, so to say. That's basically the last of these. I think it was 7 steps. Calm, heaviness of the limbs, feeling of warmth, feeling of the pulsation in the extremities, the heart, you feel that it's regular, the breathing, the abdominal function, and the coolness. So if you wish, 8. So, and then you take this back. So you move your arms, you move your legs, You take a forceful, strong press. You open your eyes. And just like waking up in the morning, you stretch yourself and you tell yourself, I'm fully awake. And unless you're that, you shouldn't drive a car, for example. Yeah, you really have to stand firmly on both feet. So that's the theoretical concept. If we still have time, I can tell you how it works when it comes to anticipatory stress. So anticipatory stress means stress, fear, anxiety. The fight and flight response is increasing. We're getting nervous, perhaps intimidated, perhaps aggressive, because sympathetic system is mounting. You have to face a conversation with someone who always is mean and nasty, and you don't like it, but you have to do it. You already expect that it's going to be stressful. You have to go to the dentist or exam. Yeah, exam. You hate it. And I have experienced students. I had to do a lot of, as head of the examiners committee, I had to give a lot of medical exams to students, board exams to full-fledged neurologists. I would experience that some of those students whom I knew well, I knew they know a lot. They were so nervous that the answer didn't come. So when you give them a little bit of time to relax, just half a minute or so, they talk. It's functioning. That's the anticipatory stress, the anticipatory anxiety. This one study, what did we do? We asked two groups of students. They had nothing to do with medicine, but students from the university. We told them, okay, you get a few bucks of money if you participate, and you have to come twice. First meeting, and then 2 weeks later again. And we asked them, do you want to learn organic training, or you just want to come back? So we made sure that around half and half, one group had organic training, the other didn't. What did we do during the first and the second test? The same procedure. We did 9 electrical stimuli as they are conventionally done in clinical neurophysiology. When you measure the conduction velocity of a nerve, of a sensory nerve, you apply a little, for sensory particularly, very little electrical current. So that the, yes, it's not pleasant, but we want people to come back. So we tested what is the upper level this particular person accepts on a scale 0, no pain, 10, I'm never going to come back and you're a terrible person. So 5 would be the utmost we would go to. And we made sure we never exceeded that. But we always try to stay below. So we wanted to make sure they come back. And we said there are 3 types of stimuli. Very mild, which you probably might not even feel. Moderate, which are somewhere in between. And those that are very close to what you consider, now it gets unpleasant. And we said, we don't know what the machine does. It works at random, automatically. We have no influence. That wasn't really true. I mean, of course, we knew what we do, but we had to tell them, you know, we don't know. But, you know that the electrical charge, it needs some time. If you have a stronger stimulus, it takes longer. So we assume that when you have to wait longer, it is more intense. So when it was a short stimulus. We always said, the stimulus is going to come within the next 180 seconds, 3 minutes. First stimulus comes, you see, you announce it, and you see how heart rate increases, how blood pressure goes up. We measure every heartbeat, every pulsation of the blood pressure. So we measure continuously, not every 5 minutes. every beat. And we can see heart rate goes up, 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 up. Blood pressure also goes up, up, up. We measure the perfusion of the fingertip that shows us whether there's a lot of sympathetic activity. Goes down, 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 down. So vasoconstriction. The longer you wait, the more anxiety, the higher the heart rate. When I unexpectedly do such a stimulation in you, your heart rate will, after the stimulus, go up because it's an arousal. Arousal brings up your blood pressure, brings up your heart rate. In these guys, immediately upon the moment when we delivered the stimulus, they were relieved. They said, that wasn't bad. And heart rate and blood pressure, whoop, immediately went down to resting state. The longer the stimulus, the more anticipatory anxiety, the higher the heart rate, the higher the sympathetic responses, the worse the blood flow, constriction is very high. And then in one group, we did nothing. They came back 2 weeks later. And in the other group, we started. I gave them 6 45-minute or 1 hour training sessions of autogenic training. And I told them, please, at home, try to practice this once or twice a day. Did they practice? I have no idea. Students have other things to do. So they came back, and I guess some practices home, everyone, I don't know. But they had definitely these 6 sessions. Their anticipatory anxiety was cut in half. Of course, we did also tests using scales. How painful was it? How much anxiety did you perceive? How much discomfort did you have? How unpleasant was it, etc.? And the group that had no training, their values were just as high and some even higher than before because they knew, okay, I have to go there again. I don't like it. It's a waste of time, but I'll get $50 and done. Okay. So no improvement of the discomfort, of the pain, etc. In those who had the 6 sessions, it was cut in half or even less. And the change in blood pressure was much less. So blood pressure didn't go up before the stimulus came. And of course, also dropped after the stimulus. Heart rate didn't increase that much. So first it went up here and then just a little bit. And that is a clear sign. And the psychological parameters also were cut in half. So anxiety, discomfort, etc. Respiration was flat, was at 6 cycles per minute. And they did it without any intervention, but I assume they all did autogenic training while the stimulation was performed. So it clearly shows that the technique helps you reduce anticipatory stress. And it's not something that is a cure for everything. Of course not. I mean, it doesn't heal cancer. It doesn't heal a broken leg. But if someone has a broken leg, has an accident, they have a lot of stress, which can be in someone who, let's say, has coronary artery disease and is at risk of a myocardial infarction. It can be very dangerous. So relaxation is very important in such a situation after an accident. In patients who had a head injury, traumatic brain injury, after stroke, they have a disarranged autonomic nervous system. Rinken and co-workers in the Northern Manhattan Stroke Study showed that around 7%, 6.something% of their patients 5 years after the stroke died, and half of the fatalities, or 44%, I guess, were due to sudden unexplained deaths. That's triggered by acute stress. In most cases, sudden unexplained death is due to acute stress. With autogenic training, you can avoid that. You can, I don't want to say you can avoid any case of sudden fatality, but you can, of course, mitigate stress drastically.
That is an extremely important message, and you definitely need to come back as a guest here, Max, because there are so many things we still need to discuss. But but if I am to sum up this episode in brief, then we have spoken about autogenic training being a part of the medical toolbox that we have, that it's definitely shown that it has an effect, not only in being in stressful situations, but also in anticipatory stress, if you are facing an exam, you are facing a procedure that's going to be unpleasant, you can use autogenic training in order to cope better and also to get better back to yourself afterwards. And as you say, there is no universal tool. This you can't heal everything, but it can be very helpful in coping, and that is a huge value in itself. So I hope that the listeners had a lot of value from this, because I really had. It was very interesting talking to you, and I'm definitely going to give autogenic training a shot. I do some breathing exercises, but you explain it very neatly with the 8 steps. You start on the outside and then you proceed to the inside, and then you again, when you go back to your normal you, then you again start on the outside, erasing the inside as well. So do not forget the 8 steps, people, and definitely go for this if there are situations that you are fearing, because it involves a lot of stress, or if you are having a chronic stress situation, and probably it could be good for everybody. So thanks again, Max, for joining us on the Brain Health Mission podcast. We are approaching the end, and I'm also very happy that we have listeners who have joined us for this very interesting conversation. And we hope that those who are following us on a regular basis still will do, and that those who just jumped in for this episode will be intrigued and perhaps follow us further. So you can follow us on your preferred podcast platform, and please feel free to share it with your network and stay tuned for more conversations on brain health. And there will be more to come, and also probably an episode on more autogenic training in the future. Thank you so much, Max.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Brain Health Mission podcast, where science meets action for a healthier brain. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or your favorite podcast app so you never miss an update. For more tools, tips, and expert insights, head to brainhealthmission.org. That's brainhealthmission.org. Until next time, take care of your brain. It's the only one you've got.